You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to DubLab Radio. This is your host, Ale, here on Elevation Through Sound. And today, really honored, really happy and excited to have two very special guests to me in conversation. We have Jared Artaud, and Liz Lamire. I hope I'm pronouncing your names correctly.
Close enough. I'm actually Lamarie.
Lamarie. Fantastic. And hello, Jared, and both of you, Liz and Jared, thank you so much for joining today. And thank you so much for taking some time to talk about the work of Alan Vega and then the latest record, Mutator, that you two worked together on, and even hopefully more. So it's wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having us. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And for those out there trying to get familiar with the new work with Mutator, maybe let's start with that. There's so much we can talk about here, obviously. But in terms of Mutator, that is a work that you two collaborated on in producing and came out recently, right, on Sacred Bones?
Yes, Mutator was actually an album that Alan and I had recorded the music for back in the mid-90s. And then Jared and I had discovered the ADAT tapes for in 2019. And we collaborated on producing and mixing the album. Jared, do you want to speak to that? There's a whole backstory.
Yeah.
It was actually pretty amazing. Liz called me and was like, I think you have to come over. I lived one stop away from Alan and Liz in Brooklyn. You know, I'd hop over the East River and be over to their apartment in like 20 minutes, and got really close to Alan before he died. So I had done that prior to discovering Mutator with Liz, and she called me and said, "Come, you have to come over here. I found something." And we discovered these tapes, these ADAT tapes, and we knew there was something special. We just had no idea what was on those tapes. So we got my close friend and longtime engineer, Ted Young, to transfer those tapes. And when we opened them up and got them into the digital zone, it was like a flash memory for Liz, and she remembered these songs. And it was from that moment where we were discovering what that cluster of material was, which kind of launched Liz back into the mid-90s, like 95, 96.
It was crazy. Yeah, literally, I felt Alan's presence. We both had chills. And I could hear even tracks. I can almost remember, because I was playing the machines then. I had been recording albums with Alan since the late 80s, early 90s, when we did Deuce Avenue together. And we did a few solo albums. And then we did Du Jang Prang. Henry Rollins had come to New York and had started a record label. And prior to Du Jang Prang, we would sometimes spend 2 or 3 years just working on creating sounds and experimenting with sounds. And to put it into context, when I met Alan, he was just coming off Elektra Records, where everything was really produced. You had the top producers and you're bringing in songwriters and all of this kind of thing. And at the same time, he was living at the Gramercy Park Hotel and experimenting with sounds. Linking together guitar pedals and rhythm machines and just creating crazy sounds. So we started going into the recording studio together. And because I had been a drummer in bands, Alan said to me, well, you've got a great sense of rhythm. We can start just creating sounds together and layering sounds and that sort of thing. So we would often spend 2 or 3 years creating an album, and there would be 20 or 30 quote, air quote, songs. And I would say, let's release an album. And then Alan would kind of focus in on the 9 or 10 songs that felt like they were holistically a conceptual whole. And then he would write lyrics, and that the music would be done. He would go into the vocal studio and do the vocal takes for the entire album in basically one session, one take, that sort of thing. Sometimes they'd do more. Yeah, it was incredible. But because of that process, for each album we recorded and released, there would be 10 or 20 or 30 songs in some instances that weren't left behind because he didn't like them. That was just the process. So after Do Jang Prang, which we did relatively quickly, we started working on the songs that became Mutator. So there was a conceptual whole, and there were songs that were kind of a cluster, but he had gone in, he had recorded the vocals, but he, for some reason, hadn't decided that it was finished musically. He was experimenting, and the sounds were evolving that he was working on. So he wanted to go back and revisit the music. So he did that. So it was actually one step further, but we hadn't mixed the album when I, for personal reasons, couldn't come into the studio for a while. And he started working on other tracks that became the next released album, which was 2007. So when we discovered this and we start playing them, I'm having these thoughts. I'm like, holy shit.
It came to my whole period of your life, probably came to mind, right? All
Absolutely.
Of a sudden.
I felt like I was right back there. And Jared, knowing Alan really well, he was getting chills too. And the other thing that's interesting about it is by that time, Jared had gotten very close to Alan, but the initial impetus for that was Jared had reached out on behalf of himself and his partner, Brian, the band, The Vacant Lots. They had covered a Vegas song. And Jared, maybe you can speak to that, because it's a really interesting story how the three of us connected.
That was going to be my question, actually. How did that relationship come about, and how you guys met, and how not just met, but because just like anyone, Alan probably met lots of people, but how you guys connected to that other level that led to creative collaborations.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the ultimate. We were asked to be part of this Christmas album compilation that Iggy Pop and Psychic Ills and some other bands that we really liked were part of. And I remember just going, yeah, we'll do it. And then looked to Brian, my bandmate, and said, what the fuck song are we going to, like, what Christmas song are we going to cover? So after like perusing through the list of traditional Christmas songs and almost bailing on the project, I had done a little bit of research and kind of went through, you know, this kind of crazy record searching for any Christmas song that just didn't sound like a Christmas song, and discovered the Z Christmas record from 1981. And there was a song on there, No More Christmas Blues, by Alan. And it blew me away. It was like so depressing and sad and just like, it was like a Charles Bukowski poem, like come to life, you know, on Christmas. And it reminded me of like Johnny Ace, who like blew his brains out on Christmas. And I was like, I fucking love this. It's like everything I think Christmas is like. I know it's like really fucked up to say, but it really resonated with me. And the song was just incredible. And so we just kind of decided to cover that and just kind of flip it and give it more of like a dance beat and put a little bit of a spin on it. And I sent it to Liz. So we were like Facebook friends, and I sent her a message and just, you know, said to her how, out of appreciation, you know, to Alan, I mean, he really inspired me, and his work, I mean, continues to inspire me, and is, you know, largely responsible for, you know, our development as a band. And, you know, and also, you know, kind of prefaced it with, you know, hope, you know, he doesn't think we butchered his track, and just to kind of protect myself, and not expecting anything in return other than to just say thanks. You know, I've never, I think one thing for me that's really been important in my development as an artist is to never be afraid to reach out to other artists who've inspired you, even if it's just to say thanks or to collaborate with them. And surprisingly, Liz, you know, I think she was out and about, and she was like, "I'll play it for Alan when I get home."
When I get
and
home. Later
that, yep. Yeah. And later that
day. If I can interject, because I didn't know the vacant lots, but there was just something about the way Jared approached me that I'm like, I'm curious to hear this track. And so I waited to listen. You know, I brought it home. And if I may, Jared, I can
tell. Yeah, for sure.
As you can imagine, a lot of people would send Alan things. And, I played this track for Alan, and he immediately was, "Who is this? Da 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 da. Like, where are they? When can we meet them?" This planet, like, they brought something to this that you can't even put your finger on what it was about it. But it just really resonated with Alan. And there was a certain soulfulness or whatever it was. And by happenstance, they were on tour with, I guess it was Dean Wareham.
Yeah.
So when I reached out to Jared to tell him that Alan wanted to meet him, they happened to be like, and he's like, "Can we have them over for brunch?" And it was so bizarre because Alan never invited me. It was so interesting. So Jared, you can take it from here.
Yeah, so it was incredible. Like we... So first of all, like I said to Brian, like, "Hey, do you want to have brunch with Alan Vega and Liz Lamoureux?" And Brian's like, "What?" Just knowing that, I think, you know, that Alan and Liz listened to it was just, I mean, it was like the ultimate, you know. So I remember, so it was a couple hours before soundcheck, and we were doing a show at Bowery Ballroom with Dean Wareham, and we're on our way over to their apartment, and we park. I don't even think I told you, Liz, but I think I got a parking ticket because there was like no park around. I was like, "Fuck it." You know what I mean? We're meeting the king of fucking punk. And so you parked her car and you're going up the elevator. I'm like sweating and really nervous. And I think like Alan's going to come to the fucking door with like a chainsaw or some shit, you know,
exactly.
Like with a leather jacket and a fucking chainsaw. It's like, "Come in, motherfucker." So I was like,
"You want hush browns?"
So I was like, "Brian, you go first. You know?
Yeah, right.
Let him meet you first." And so we walk in and it was like, I mean, he was the nicest, coolest, funniest, smartest, just like, I also felt like I've known him forever. He just put off this like immense generosity and made his time so available. Like there was nothing else but the time he was spending with you. And it was beyond comfortable. It just made, you know, it really, you know, Alan had a way of, you know, not making it all about himself. Even when you wanted to know everything, you know, like I wanted to interview him and, you know, talk about suicide and solo records and, you know.
It would be all about you, right, Jared?
Because exactly.
Well, but
Alan, he was very generous of spirit. He saw something in this and heard something, and he was so interested in nurturing it and being a mentor, because it's like, this is the future. This is the next generation. They're doing something. There's something there. And he would say about Jared, he just gets it, because they could talk about, I mean, you guys started doing a deep dive. It reminded me of when he first met Henry Rollins. They're often running about philosophy and jazz musicians and like all kinds of relatively obscure stuff but there was such an interest in nurturing the next generation. Alan was very, a lot of artists have big egos and they're almost threatened by, you know, "What are these people doing? I'm not doing," kind of thing. It was quite the opposite with him. He loved that. So that was a big part of the connection right away.
And when it comes to Alan, it strikes me that when you say things such as, "Well, he wasn't making it about himself," it probably, correct me, Liz, if I'm wrong, but I can imagine someone that was still hungry for new ideas, someone that he was getting as much out of this as Jared was getting. He wanted to know more about it. He just, out there? I mean, he wanted to kind of discover what's new maybe and continue the exploration, maybe?
Alejandro, that's an interesting observation. But in this case, Alan was not, it was very unique in that regard. He didn't listen to a lot of other music. what he heard was, this is talent, and I want to encourage them to not get discouraged, because the music business can be very difficult. But he didn't need to glean ideas from other. It was really interesting, because he always wanted to find something he hadn't heard before. And I think that's one of the things that also set Alan apart as extremely unique. And that might be why he wasn't, quote, commercial, because he wasn't trying to emulate things that were commercial or that popular or anything like that. In fact, if he had heard something before, he would move in another direction. But what resonated with him about them is, they didn't just take my thing and try to, you know, copy it or whatever. They made it their own. And what they did as their own was so unique and interesting that I want to encourage them to keep going, because they are very creative in their own lane doing what they do. So it was more about that. And that's when I talk about generosity of spirit and not feeling competitive, because he was only competing with himself to find new things. Mm-hmm. Really, honestly, he didn't listen to a lot of what was happening of the moment, other than rap and hip hop. He loved hearing what was happening in the streets, yes, and that the sounds they were creating. But again, that didn't inspire him to think, how are they getting that sound? Because I want to get that sound. It inspired him to be like, wow, they're breaking new ground. I got to break new ground too. Like, and where can I find that? And seriously, he used to joke with me, because I had more of a pop, a little bit more of a pop sensibility, you know, melody lines and whatnot. But if he had heard something that he thought he had heard before, he would need to pivot away from it, which was really interesting. So it was more about nurturing and encouraging something that he thought, they're onto something. They're doing something really good. And he knew how difficult it was to, and at the time, right, Jared, I mean, you guys were really kind of just starting to get some traction and get to be known in the business. So it was, when they asked us to collaborate, Alan loved that idea.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was awesome. We just put out our first record, and, you know, you guys, and, you know, Alan generously like remixed a song, and we did a split 10 inch together. And then on our second album, you know, Alan's vocals are on the last track. And so it's just through collaboration.
It's interesting with the split tenant. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Alan.
No, go ahead.
No, yeah, and on the other end of the spectrum, when we talk about new influences versus the other end, which would be, were there artists, were there sounds, were there a handful of songs that were his recurrent inspiration, those things that he just never walked away from. That is what held his musical DNA, you know, those five songs that he discovered when he was 10 that he just never left behind. Or what was there any such thing there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the soulfulness of, you know, early on it was Elvis or Roy Orbison or, Jared, he probably discussed this with you, but it tended to be that roots rock and roll, the real jazz guys, Eric Dolphy and
Albert Eiler, Coltrane, Fred Sanders. Yeah,
exactly. Classical music, Tchaikovsky, Mozart. Mm-hmm. I mean, he loved listening to classical music. So again, it wasn't necessarily like his contemporaries. It was really the stuff that was really hardwired into him. And the common theme was, which is interesting, because when you're working with electronic music, it can be very sterile. But Alan, he brought the blood and the guts in and the sexuality into it through, again, those early influences that really stayed with him throughout. And he wasn't trying to emulate their sound, but their energy and their feeling is what I think really inspired him.
Yes, and you were talking about the idea of Alan in a way. I don't know if the idea is like flirting with or struggling with finding a balance between his artistic ambitions and fame. The idea of pop stardom or pop music and just doing his thing and experimenting. And you were saying earlier today when he was with Elektra, it was all about production, it about polishing a product, while at the same time he was living in a hotel room, right? And he was experimenting with sound right at the same time that he would have been in a period of polishing this pop persona, maybe. So it sounds to me that there was a back and forth on what his ambitions were on one end and what the other ambitions were on the other end.
Well, can I just actually add something to that? I think, for me, like, first and foremost, like, with Alan, he lived and breathed art. You know, I've always, I don't really put him, although he is part of the lineage of, like, Elvis, Prince, David Bowie, Alan Vega. He's such an icon and such a, legendary musical figure. But he's really like a visual artist working in sound, at least in my perspective. Mm-hmm. It was the art first and not the ambition or the, like, the networking or the, like, I'm going to get famous. He seemed so concentrated and focused on the craft of what he was doing versus the ambition or the aspiration to fame.
Yes. That was my question. Were there two sides to it, or there was, because sometimes you hear it in artists that struggle between the material and the spiritual kind of thing.
Right. I love this question because it really gets to the heart of who Alan was as a person. And we used to joke that he was the reluctant rock star because he was that diamond in the rough that they could see, the big machine could see how they could polish him up and plug him in. But at the same time, he was afraid that that was taking away his soul. And that's why he had to go back and still experiment, even though they're trying to polish him up and put him out there. I think for him, he used to joke and say, I'm the research scientist in the basement. He didn't want to have to be out on the big stage. And yet part of him liked the fact that there was an appreciation for what he was doing because that might enable him to keep doing more. But he was not materialistic at all. He wasn't, in today's world, the whole rock star mentality of you need to, like, have all the, toys and look really slick and all this, the signs of success, the traditional signs of success. As he got older, he had less and less interest in that. It was really about creating music and art. And he started out as a visual artist. So what Jared said before about him, Jared has called him an architect of sound, or he's literally sculpting the sound. So he had that 3D, he did sculptures. So he literally would be sculpting sound. And for him, that was always the driver. It was always about creating the fame and the commercial success. It was more a question of then being able to facilitate still doing it, still being able to do it, pay the bills, encourage other people, that sort of thing. But I don't think,
And it's important when you say the phrase paying the bills, right? Mm-hmm. That will take any artist that is trying or does make a living out of this. There's always that, there's next month's bills, you have to pay them. And when you are on this trajectory that is so personal, that is just so about your vision, like Alan, that wasn't on the side composing for films or for TV or producing and doing all these other things to pay the bills. What were the day-to-day struggles, or what were the day-to-day routines that he kept to stay creative, to stick to his guns in a way? Did he have daily things that kept it going?
That's a great question. The first and foremost, he used to say, again, and I love quoting him because these, I think, speak to his ethos: I could live in a refrigerator box on the Bowery. He was also fortunate to be partnered with me because I did have a day job, so that helped. But even if he wasn't with me, he would have lived in a refrigerator box in the Bowery to be able to focus on his thing. If somebody asked him to do sound for a film, he wouldn't be averse to doing that. He did a soundtrack for Philippe Grandjour, a film out of a French filmmaker. A movie about a serial killer, Sombre. Yeah. And Steve reached out to us and said, I'm inspiring or motivating my lead actor to get in the right mindset by playing your music. Alan loved that
movie. That was great.
So we asked to license some stuff. And then we floated the idea of, what about Alan just doing some music for the film? He ended up doing the soundtrack. That was one of his favorite things that he ever did. I mean, he absolutely loved doing that.
Have you heard that, man?
I haven't actually. I wasn't familiar with
you
that.
You should check it out. It's really cool.
Great.
And when Alan first, you know, he was married for 10 years in a very domesticated, and, you know, he loved his first wife. But after he saw Iggy, he was saying to himself, if I want to be true to myself as an artist, and he was mostly painting then, although he had always, even in the 60s, he was walking around recording sounds in the street and playing with electronic machines and recording the sounds that the machines were making, like just getting static on the transistor radio or turning, you know, turning, just make, creating sounds. So he was doing that early on before he thought of himself as a musician. But then he sees Iggy and he decides, if I'm going to be true to myself as an artist, I need to get out of my comfort zone. So he had been working for the welfare department early on and as his day job when he was married. And this was between 1960 and 1970 after he graduated from college, where he started as an astrophysics major. So he's really bright in science and math. But it was always doodling when he was growing up. He was always doodling and he was doodling in one of the case books or textbooks, and the head of the math department happened to come by and said, what is your major? Looking at what he was drawing. And he said, it's physics. He said, it should be art. And so he said, you know what? I'm going to, and he did. He transferred his major to art. So, but he was studying painting. So he goes and goes into Manhattan and basically got funding from the New York State Arts Council to open this building. And he was going to be supposedly the janitor. And it was a place like Andy Warhol's factory, where people could just come, drop in, do art, music, whatever. Alan didn't have a job. He didn't really have, I think they paid him a very small stipend. He's eating day-old bread behind the bakery. You know, he's pulling in things that people had thrown away. Because at this point, he's doing paintings, but at one stage, he put a light on the painting. He's walking back and forth across this painting and saying, depending on the light that I'm looking at, it's either purple or black. And so he puts a light on the painting and he says, maybe I should be doing sculptures. And then he just starts bringing in garbage that people had thrown away, but interesting things, maybe electronic computers or old TVs. And then he gets wires and piles of lights and he starts putting them on the floor. And then Ivan Karp, who had discovered Andy Warhol, comes into this building to see who the artists are. And a lot of the visual artists are going up and down the strip in Soho with their slides of their work, trying to get gallery shows. And Alan, again, razor-like focused on just creating, not even thinking about, I'm going to go get gallery shows. Ivan Karp walks in and says, how soon can you be ready for an exhibition, a one-man show? So this was, his whole career was like that. It wasn't about, let me go hustle for work. It was like, I can survive off the street. If I need to go get the bakery bread, I'm fine. He was skinny as a rail, you know, and seriously, because it was literally all, and I saw the way he lived when he lived with me. And it's interesting because it was all about, he'd get up, he'd be drawing, he'd be writing, he'd be pulling the stuff he pulled into the street, he'd be configuring into sculptures, and then we'd be in the studio two or three nights a week and he'd be working on music. And it was just, that was it. He wasn't thinking, we got to get this gig or we got to do it. In fact, as his manager, I used to joke because people would approach him and they'd say, oh, can you come do this show or whatever? And I would get him to agree. He would always say no at first. And the guy director would say, oh my God, he's so unmanageable. It's really difficult. Because he was the kind of person that would vent. He would let you know what he was thinking or feeling in the moment. And then he'd be like totally relaxed and cool. And that's why we scare the shit out of people sometimes. That it was really just him venting because he had angst and he wanted to, don't distract me, I'm trying to do this thing. And so people, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I just get excited. Yeah. So we used to joke that I would be the one, I wouldn't take no for an answer because that's just my personality. Well, why? I want to understand why. So then he would agree to something. And then sure enough, by the time it came to do it, and it might be a show where he's getting paid a good amount of money, you got to get this thing. I'm like, what the hell, you already agreed to? And then he would go perfectly gracious and charming and enjoy it. But he would have a little bit of, and he used to say that about Elvis. Elvis used to say, if I wasn't nervous before going on stage, then I shouldn't be going out there anymore. And Alan was like that. He'd get like, and maybe that's because he would have axes thrown at his head when he was touring with The Clash. So he had a little bit of anxiety before going out on stage. But that's another interesting aspect in terms of the personality, that Marty, as Suicide, Marty and Alan believed so strongly that they were breaking new ground and what they were doing should be heard, and that they loved it. They thought, this is great. They couldn't understand why people are like, this is awful, or just crazy, you know. And then when people would have this crazy adverse reaction, and be throwing stuff at them. Alan figured, you know what? I'm gonna make them think that I'm crazier than they are. How could I be afraid of you throwing stuff at me when I'm breaking bottles and cutting my face open? And that's what he would do, literally, to scare them into thinking, oh, this guy's a lunatic.
I had the opportunity to meet briefly Martin Rev once in backstage when he played here in Los Angeles at Zebulon. And I just couldn't believe that the warmth and sweetness that came out of him when I met him after doing this crazy, really intense show. And yes, in a way, you take it as it becomes your art form, right? But that's not who you are. That's just It's a different thing. I mean, similar to Jared, what you were saying before meeting him, you think he's going to come up with a chainsaw to cut the hash brown during a brunch, you know? But it strikes me as someone that was just like his main word's not struggle. His main purpose was to remain surrounded by a creative life, right? A life of creativity, and the rest would kind of work itself out in a way.
Yes. And he was willing to take whatever it required. Yep. There was no compromise. There was no compromise in terms of the stage performances with Suicide, where they were willing to go out there and literally put their lives on the line, especially Alan, because he was in the front line of fire. Yes. And he said, I believe so strongly in what I was doing that, let, you know, come at me, throw a knife at me, throw an axe at me. And I'm willing to stand up and stand by what I'm doing. I also like what you asked before about, like, how did he, in terms of dealing with some of the struggles, for him it was the drawing and the writing. So every night, like clockwork, like when you asked about his day-to-day routine,
yes,
every single night at the end of the night, he would sit and he would do portrait drawings, and then he would do his writing, and it would be stream of consciousness stuff. He liked doing that way more than when there was an album and it's like, okay, now I have to come up with set lyrics. But what he would do is he would go to those writings, and we have stacks and stacks of his writings of poetry and stream of consciousness and prose and just thoughts, yes, and the portrait drawings. That was how he got out it was a catharsis for him.
To me, I always see creativity as a muscle that you need to exercise. Yeah. Just like if you were an athlete, you need to work out, you need to train. And I always see it that way. And you don't go from nothing, from, you know, doing whatever, working or do day-to-day stuff, to recording a full album. You need to daily stay in shape creatively. Mm-hmm. And these are the things probably that he did. They were maybe not meant to be a final product. They weren't meant to be a final piece. They were just his way to working that muscle in a way. Strikes me odd. One of the things...
I just wanted to interject. Sorry, it's okay. That's a really beautiful analogy that you have for yourself too. I also think, though, with Alan and some other artists, I can relate to this too. It's not only just a muscle, because there's like a spiritual element to it. You know, there's like the heart and spirit, you know, it's this kind of thing that you tap into that goes beyond your flesh and your muscles. And I think Alan, more than anyone I've ever met, was really tapped into this kind of universal. I've discovered it in like poetry, like Rimbaud, for example. Jim Morrison and the Doors were kind of getting into that zone, but it seemed like Alan was really tapped into this kind of like universal thing or universal mind or method. You're not just tapped into the shit that goes on Earth, but the things that go out in space. And yes,
there's
freaky
physics. Yeah.
Yeah. And with electricity, there's no muscle, but there's electricity. It's invisible, but it's, you know, it's there. And I think that there's an aspect of the art process that relies on that, on intuition and instinct, and not so much on physical strength. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like Alan, more than, you know, anyone I've really ever met, was really in tune with that. And I think part of what drove him creatively wasn't so much in the kind of exercise of it, but more to what Liz was saying in terms of the kind of like spiritual of the work, and where that would lead to, and what he would leave behind, and what he was connected to, and how he can connect to other people with, whether that's on Earth and in space, and everything in between. If that makes sense. No, not in a metaphysical way, but in a right. kind of like personally spiritual, but connecting with other people universally.
And that's correct. That it strikes me as you know, at times you were saying, Liz, that after a suicide show, he would come out of stage and saying, how can no one like this? How come this is something that, you know, we think is the groundbreaking? And in trying to connect to the future, present, the past, present, future of creativity, was there a sense of vindication that he had over the years? Did he feel that he fulfilled that mission? Did he feel that he was part of that as Jared just said, that continuum, that legacy, right? That cosmic conversation that happens among generations of creative people that connect on Earth and maybe beyond.
I love this because this does tap into, I believe, what Alan was feeling and experiencing on this plane, and what Jared said about the electricity. It's no surprise that he became a light artist. I think that he used to say to me that music is about the movement of sound through time, and the music that he created was timeless, because as Jared indicated, he was tapping into universal themes somehow that go beyond the day-to-day mundane existence or what's happening in our world at this moment in time. It's almost like that collective unconscious, or the, you know, he was tapping into spirit guides. When he was getting to the point where he knew he was passing over to the next realm, he was drawing faces. He had done portrait drawings for decades and decades and decades. Now the portraits didn't have faces, which was really interesting. And then he went back to painting. He hadn't painted in quite a while. And he was doing these paintings again without faces, and the spirits, which I called them spirits, and he was like, yeah. And they were really from different, this one guy that looks like he's from medieval times, and then there's somebody else who's in another period in time. It's really, really interesting that the last series of paintings he did, and there were seven of them. But he also, I just completely lost my train of thought.
The last
series of paintings. I also wanted to just add to something that Liz was saying that was really crucial to this kind of like more spiritual aspect, and not spiritual, again, just to be clear, not in like a religious or kind of spiritual or metaphysical way, but in a sense that, you know, part of Alan's process and a lot of artists who have inspired me were going through the unknown, you know, and that is the ability to take risks, but the ability to night after night, like if you have a routine and you go to have a workout, you know how many reps you're going to do and you're working your muscles or doing your training, or, you know, there's a plan, there's a system. You're not going in there and be like, whoa, I didn't know I was going to bench 250. I mean, yeah, maybe, but
I remember what I was going to say now that you're saying this. Go ahead.
So the thing, when you're going through the unknown, you know, night after night, when he was doing those drawings or when he was going in there making those sounds, you're working through time and space to get something you've never heard before by going through the unknown. I mean, and to produce what Alan produced, and the power and the, you know, the kind of tapping into the human condition while also speaking
into the unconscious.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it really led him on this crazy path, you know.
Sorry, but that was the point I was going to make, because again, this is something that Alan would say. So he was feeling it, and from what I was observing, and what we all observe about the end product, he would say that when he starts either a painting or a piece of music or whatever it might be, you might have a conscious intention going in. And as Jared said, with the athlete, there's definitely conscious intention because they know what their training program is. But with Alan, he would say that you might start, and then the work itself, the piece itself, starts to become. And you're almost like the vessel that the energy is moving through to realize what it's supposed to be, kind of thing. If that doesn't sound too wacky, but it's almost like magic. And I saw many times in the studio where we would be hours and hours and hours, and he has an idea. Like, he knows that there's something that he's meant to find sonically or whatever. And we could be working and nothing seems to be clicking. And then all of a sudden it can go from sounding like a total cacophony of what the heck is this? And then suddenly the magic knows, without any conscious knowing of what it is that what happened, but then suddenly, and we'll look at each other and go, holy shit.
Wow. And it's normally, it tends to be way more interesting than what you would have had in mind, right? in a more purposeful way.
Yes.
It tends to be, yes, exactly.
And that was the beauty. That was and another thing Alan used to say, and I love saying this because I feel like I learned so much from him and I'm so grateful for that. And I think what Jared and I were able to do and what I was able to bring to the table, Jared is way more technically proficient than me, even though I mixed albums with Alan and he gave me co-producing credit and co-writing credit. But technically, Jared is super proficient, but I learned so many things from Alan just in terms of how you approach creativity. And he used to always say, there are no mistakes. And if you can free yourself up by recognizing that there are no mistakes, like give yourself over to the universe. You know, yes, you're going at it and you have some ideas and you want to be able to just explore those ideas. But if you also feel that there's no mistakes, and again, it's that there's nothing really on the line because I don't need to, I can, again, live on the refrigerator, on the Bowery in a refrigerator box. You know what I'm saying? So that also really is that creative freedom. It's very difficult to get as an artist, especially in today's world where it's not valued unless you're plugging into some machine that's cranking out a bunch of product. And so to be able to create without having to necessarily think about the machine while you're creating is a beautiful thing. Yeah. And I think again, that whole concept of there's no mistakes and things can happen seemingly randomly, and yet there's a method to the madness because you're coming at it with a certain intention, right? To find something special. And I think sometimes the intention alone can really help you get there. And that at a certain point, you just, you know, that's where the other stuff comes into play.
Yes. And when it comes to the as collaborators between, and this is a question for you, Liz, and for you, Jared, what united you as creative collaborators? It strikes me that maybe there was something more of, how can I say it? It strikes me as maybe similar to probably the collaboration he had with Martin Rev for Suicide. Something where he was relying on others for the more technical or the more practical side of these creations. Maybe in this case, the day-to-day activities that take you to create an album. Was there such thing? What was the nature of what brought you together as creators? What did he have that you didn't and what you had that he didn't?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. For me personally, it was initially more of the practical. He's thinking there are all these machines and there are keyboards and we're going to try to create all these sounds. And Liz is a drummer. She's got a good sense of rhythm. Bring her in and let's see what we do. And of course, I was an attorney on Wall Street at the time, but I was playing drums in punk bands. So I already had that creative side to me that was not being fully explored and utilized. So I was able to go in and help facilitate. In fact, our engineer who we worked with for 30 years was someone who is the engineer and owner of the studio that my band used to rehearse at. And he was a really cool laid back guy. So I figured with Alan's more intense energy, this super laid back chill guy might be a great combination. And we ended up working at his recording, Perkin Barnes at 6/8 Studios, for the next, you know, 8 albums in almost 30 years. So yes, there was for me, but again, as I said, once I got in there with him, it freed me up because I came from a place where logical reasoning and structured and, you know, on the right side of my brain versus the left side of the brain kind of thing. What I would love is with Alan was an opportunity to be totally creative. And again, that freedom of whatever, there's no mistakes and things happen. And then it was just amazing. And then with respect to working with Jared, and I'll let Jared speak to this further, but we had done a collaboration on a split single and I had gone into it. At this point, this was after Alan had had a stroke. So we weren't going into the studio as much. He was working more on his visual art. But we knew we had a ton of stuff in the what we call the vault, but that had been recorded that hadn't been released. So they wanted something that hadn't been released. So Alan says, why don't you go and take a listen with Perkin and see what's in there? And I was, first of all, I was really surprised at how much material was in there. And then I just zoomed in on a particular track and I said to Perkin, let's just take a run at mixing this today. And so we did, and I brought it back and played it for Alan. And he's like, holy shit, that sounds great. And then he said to me, whoa, we must have a ton of stuff in the Vega vault. He like dubbed it the Vega vault. And then he said, because he would always joke this way. He said, so after I'm gone, feel free to go in and do whatever you want with it. This kind of thing.
I love the Vega vault.
The Vega vault.
Amazing, right?
But if it weren't for Jared saying, hey, you know, do you guys have any unreleased stuff? We could do a split single together. I wouldn't have gone in and done that. And I wouldn't have said, you know what? Alan's probably not going to be able to get in here right away. So let me just take a run at mixing it. And then I bring it back. And he had that ultimate confidence in me that, wow, you kept it true to my vision, right? Because I'd been mixing things with him before.
Yes.
And I know what he likes. So I wouldn't do something really crazy that wouldn't be his thing. And so the fact that he was able to say, wow, that sounds great. Holy shit, that's great. There must be a lot of other stuff like that that we never even released that's really cool. And as he said in an interview once, the two people whose judgment I trust on my music are Rick Ocasek and Liz. So he said, having said that to me today, that day, and knowing how much he respected Jared and felt Jared really, as we would say, Jared really gets it. So after he did pass, knowing I had his blessing to go in and release more material, and knowing Jared was the one I reached out to master it, which was the final album that we had mixed and produced and finished. But Jared worked alongside me, making sure that the mastering was on point and was so diligent, and so his ears are so good. And so when it came time to like release more stuff from the vault, Alan would have handpicked Jared, you know, hands down. There's no question. So that's how we got to the point where we worked together on Mutator.
And when it comes to particularly you, Jared, when it comes to describing, maybe if there's like 3, 4, even 5 qualities that you think are the ones that really made you qualified, right? Or connected you. What are the principles, these principles that you guys share? Maybe they were unspoken principles, but maybe if you can put them in words, what were the things that made you or someone like Rick Ocasek or Liz that these shared unspoken values that would give you that trust into the Vega vault, you know, and understand it and do something or mix something or pick something that will represent those common shared values?
Well, I can try. I think, you know, beyond bringing my own like artistic sensibilities and instincts to my own work or any project, and especially with Alan's, you know, someone I revered, I mean, someone whose records made me want to make records, you know, and then hopefully continue that, you know, for other future generations. I think above all, music is a language. And what makes a producer great is how you can connect the pieces from the blueprints into a cohesive whole. And with Alan's music, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately because Liz and I are working on some more Vega Vault material, and something that really struck me was how Alan's music is like an engine. Like you take a car engine, right? Tesla, whatever. I don't even know. I've never looked inside the Tesla engine, but any like a car engine, a well-made car engine, and there are certain pieces that kind of go together. And when I'm working on Alan's music with Liz, I imagine or am guided towards these sounds that Alan put together, and it's sort of like guiding all the pieces to that kind of fit, right? So it's like the engine kind of elevates or levitates above, just bear with me on this analogy for a second, this engine kind of lifts up out of the car and separates, and then you've got all of Alan's sounds. And then there's something, you know, with Alan being gone and there's kind of feeling his presence here as if he's in the room, it's like he's helping, or you know, I'm channeling him or feeling his presence to kind of guide those pieces together. And then it's like a gravitational pull where they all snap together and go back into the car. And I feel like that, I guess to boil it down in one word, is intuition, you mm-hmm. know? And I can't tell you why I get Alan's music or when I listen to Suicide or any of his records that there's like a feel, there's an emotional response and a feeling I get. And this, thing that really drives me in my own work with the vacant lots and my own, you know, any records I produce is just kind of keeping your personal or artistic sensibilities and your artistic instincts and intuition true, and keeping that really real and intact. And I think that approach, honesty in the music, beyond whether, like, if you know something's good when it's good, you know, which Rick Ocasek told me when I asked him, like, how the fuck did, you know, this pop star from the Cars work with Suicide, the, like, grittiest, meanest fucking punk, you know, like, revolutionary punk band. And Rick was just like, if it's good, it's good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And they built a relationship. And I think for, you know, my relationship with Alan was just kind of this, like, let me just put it to you in a different way. I like cut my hand open on stage, and had to get like 9 stitches in London, and some stitches on my arm, and I was bleeding everywhere, and I was like so proud of all the blood that I shed on stage. Yes, you know, like, I'm up there with Iggy and Alan and fucking and the Sex Pistols, and I'm like, oh man, I can't wait to show, like, every fucking person I show those photos to thought, like, I should go to a mental institution. You know, my family, my friends, other artists, they're like, you're fucking cracked. You're mental. The only person I show those photos to who, like, got it on another level was Alan. He's like, man, that's fucking beautiful.
To bleed for the
right? You know, yeah. And I think it's just kind of like, you know, what guides you through the music, and there's the mm-hmm. instincts and your intuition. And, you know, and I think those, if you stay true to that, and I'm really lucky to have, you know, a collaborative partner like Liz too, because it's like, you know, it's the unspoken thing where we both look at each other and we just know, like, this is it, here it is.
It
strikes me as there's two sides of it that you have to have an understanding, and one of them is the beauty in tragedy, the beauty behind every dark theme or moment, right? That Alan seems to capture well, and that comes more from the color, the spirit. But then when you were saying about the engine, the analogy, the first thing I started to think was that, well, if you think about it, he did early on in his life study astrophysics, right?
Exactly.
So you're talking about someone that is somewhat mechanically minded, mm-hmm. meaning that he's thinking about the mechanisms of the cosmos, and he ended up kind of doing that in his music. Instead of understanding studying the mechanisms of the cosmos, he did it through music and to find this mechanical work, this engineering or architecture behind his pieces. Maybe is in relation to that he was somewhat mechanically minded when building these things, but also all under that color of the beauty in the darkness, the beauty in the tragedy of things.
Yeah, actually, I was actually, I love that, really great you said that, because mm-hmm. I was going to say, like, how, you know, in addition to the mechanical aspect of the music, there's something really transformative, and I think, you know, Mutator especially was about balancing a dark vision with hope.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, exactly.
And that's a theme that runs through all of his works, whether with Suicide or solo. There's that duality of beauty and brutality, because it's not just, you know, pie in the we don't just have our rose-colored glasses on. There's so much beauty, but there's also a recognition that life is no joke. Life can be hard, and there can be a lot of pain and brutality. But again, that there's that hope there. I also just wanted to speak to, like, just the process of producing, and you talk about Rick Ocasek, and I think what Jared and I are able to do that Rick also was able to do is, and Rick is somebody who, you know, can do very, very polished, beautiful work, but he had the ability to keep the soul of what Alan's message was. And there was a timelessness, again, to everything that Alan did because of that soulfulness. The other thing that was important in terms of what makes it more challenging for us is, this is not music that we're, you know, using preset, you know, sounds, and every sound on every track is something that was manipulated and morphed and mutated over, you know, many, many, many different iterations to get to that ultimate sound. And then you start layering those sounds. And Alan's sensibility was a little bit more toward, and this is why when we would be producing together and Alan and I and mixing, I would always want to hear the differentiation of sound because there were so many interesting sounds. And I'd be like, let's put compression on this so we can hear this cut through. And now, of course, there's a lot, technology allows you to get enhancement sounds. We're not changing them, but we're allowing the space so you can actually hear all the stuff that's going on. And it's really deep. There's a lot of cool stuff happening. So Jared and I are able to do that, keep the uniqueness of the sounds, but bring it to light. And Alan would have loved that. We just didn't really have the wherewithal, you know, and so we're keeping it alive. We're keeping the soul. And yet we're enhancing the sound so people can appreciate it. And what we're also doing that Alan would have loved is, about, when you're talking about his legacy, he was very grateful. He did feel that sense of, he knew he inspired many people. He wasn't selling a ton of record albums, but to him, it was more important to have that young artist or seasoned artist come up to him and say, I wouldn't have done music if it weren't for you. And he would like it even more if what they were doing is completely different from what he was doing. It was the pure message of, I inspired you to be creative. To him, that was the greatest success. That was the greatest gift. So for us now, in terms of preserving and enhancing Alan's legacy, it's about, we just want people to hear this because mm-hmm. it inspires more people to be creative and to say, hey, you know, this is an important outlet. It's not just about paying the bills. There's, you know, we're all on this planet and life can be hard, but life can also be beautiful. And some of that joy and beauty comes out of the act of creating. And that's the underlying message here. So our mission is really to get Alan's work heard by more people because we feel that that's a really big gift. And we really do feel honored to be able to do that. And so that's really important. And I know, and one of the reasons that Jared, you initially asked, why is Jared well-suited for this? Alan knew, and going back to all the conversations they had, Alan at one point said, I'm passing the torch to Jared. Because he knew that he understood and his sensibilities. And just when we started working together, as Jared said, there's that unspoken thing. We're like on the same page. And yet we have that checks and balances too. So we're not because we could get our own. We're each creative beings ourselves. So we could get ahead of ourselves. And that might be for another project where we're just doing some of the sounds from the vault, but we collaborate with another artist and we do something completely different. But when it comes to an Alan Vega project, we are making absolutely sure that Alan is sitting right there with us.
And you could feel him with us.
Man, that's great. Like when I came home with that first track, he's like, holy shit, that sounds great. You know, that same thing. That's our mission. That's kind of the parameters that we're working in when we're working on an Alan Vega product. Because people will say that, oh, you know, it wasn't mixed by Alan. I'm like, excuse me, motherfuckers. I was there for 30 years with Alan.
I think, anyone who's qualified to render
Exactly.
And if I didn't, Alan would be right up there saying, he sent me signals. He sent us so many signals. We believe in that energy is still there, and he's still very much with us.
Yeah.
And just something he would be proud of, you know, like for me, that's like the number one driving thing. But like, because...
And happy that more people are hearing it. And again, it's not about the paycheck. It's about... holy shit, people are hearing my stuff. Dream Baby Dream was used, it was a cover version by Karen O in the World Series. Now, Alan, you talk about athletes. Alan, as a young boy, was a great baseball player. He swam. He was a lifeguard. People don't realize this about him. What they also don't realize about him is he was an avid sports fan. He could remember every team, every player, stats, blah, 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 blah. And I come from Boston where my family's like really into sports. I actually am a competitive boxer still, and I manage professional fighters. Alan, he thought athletes were artists, like tremendous artists. So he would have loved that analogy. I completely forgot my where I was going with this. But
working on the producing and the music how, you know, something that he would be proud of as well. You know, I think that's the whole idea and connecting it with other people.
Right. Not doing it for the paycheck, but doing it like for like, yeah, again, inspiring more people. And he believed this stuff is timeless. He used to say that all the time about suicide. We weren't ahead of our time. We were just right where we were in time. And what is time? You know, time is a construct and we're still in what, so what he's doing, it's so funny when people say like, oh, this was done and da-da-da. It didn't matter. It didn't matter what decade, the stuff he was doing in the 90s, Jared, we're listening to the stuff now for this next
episode. It's so relevant. It's crazy.
Holy shit.
It's intense. It's crazy. It sounds like it could have been made like, you know, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Or 30 years from now on Mars.
And I think that's something that Liz and I we've really, you know, as much as we use restraint, you know, because we want to like honor his music and manifest his vision, you know, and not put like our spin on it. But we, you know, we're able to make the music modern. So it sounds like of today, which really goes in correspondence with his, you know, universal and timelessness in his music. You know, like records sound like they do in the 90s from the 90s for a certain, you know, the technology or the engineers or the producers or whatever.
And also because they were using the same machines and basically going to what get out of the machine pretty quickly. And Alan used to say that. He's like, whatever I'm getting out of the machine pretty quickly. First of all, I don't even want to look at the manual because I don't want to have any idea how to actually get sound out of this thing.
Yes.
So we're going in blind. And then if you hear some, that's something that you, then you have to manipulate it. Then it goes through something else. Then you morph it through something else. And then you layers. So by the time you finish, people will be like, well, where did this sound come from? So that also is, it doesn't have a time stamp. Yeah. Whereas you can hear, I mean, you know, different periods, people are using the popular, whatever's, you know, different machines become popular and you can kind of hear it. Oh, that was Planet Fat from 1996, you know, whatever, you know what I mean? But you would never be able to earmark that with what Alan was doing because he just kept morphing it.
And just one other thing I'll add, you know, as you can see, we both get really excited and kind of emotional and speaking about this, because it's not just like, oh, these are just songs, you know, here's some chords and this is the verse and chorus. It's like, here's the start, here's the end. But I think the approach and ability to put so much human and humanity through the machines and through electronic music to make it sound so, you know, unelectronic.
Exactly.
And human, I think, is...
The blood is pumping through that heart.
Yeah.
That is one of the big challenges, I think, with the electronic music, and he was so successful at that.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
And what he would say, too, which really rings true, is no matter what I did, suicide, Alan Vega solo, art, visual... My fingerprint is all over. You can see.
Yeah.
That's why I laugh when you know, because some people, you know, you get people on the internet saying like, you know, how is this? Why is this a legitimate Alan Vega? He's not here. Da da da. His fingerprints are all over this thing. It's undeniable.
That's great. Well, I really look forward to more things coming from the Vega Vault, and what, you know. I want to, you know, getting to know an artist that even way past his passing, there's still more to be discovered and to be understood. And even just as much as I've been listening to Suicide since the mid-90s when I discovered them, I thought I knew him in some way. And today I come out knowing a different kind of Alan Vega that I suspected in some ways. And there's some pleasant surprises that I didn't know about, like sports, for example. Yeah. But really seriously, just I'm really excited on what you, Liz, and Jared continue to bring out from his work, and to know that it's in good hands, and hopefully continue on this cosmic conversation that he started many years ago.
Well, thanks a lot, man. Just honored to be part of this, you know.
Thank you, Alejandro.
Keep this legacy alive.
Yeah. I just want to say one further thing. I can't tell you how many people have reached out to me and Jared to thank us, but to say I needed to hear Alan's voice.
Yeah.
So the fact that there's so much more there, that he's still giving that gift, I love it. It's just so important. We're on a mission. So.
Yes.
We're on a mission.
Well, thank you so much. It's been so wonderful talking to you, Liz, and to you, Jared. Thank you so much for your time and sharing so candidly all these stories, all these ideas. And really, I think you allowed me to in a way, explore myself a bit more what this all means. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. I think Alan would have liked to hear that, too. So.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Too high. You destroy. You destroy generations. You take. You take to life.
Like a soldier.